This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN. The mysterious online figure called QAnon helped stoke insurrection in the US Capitol. Is QAnon also quasi-religious?
Q as a kind of repository for the truth teller, the sort of revealer of how the world is kind of inherently broken and corrupt. That certainly has a deeply religious, mystical quality.
That's ahead on the show. And why is the future of Pope Francis linked so closely with Joe Biden? That's coming up. Now, QAnon is this strange internet phenomenon that presents itself as this government insider drip-feeding to its online followers supposedly hidden truths about groups that really control the world. As we saw on the 6th of January, when hundreds of rioters overran the US Capitol, there is some overlap with Donald Trump supporters. It might surprise you to learn there's also an overlap with parts of the so-called wellness industry. Dr. Tara Isabella Burton is a columnist with the Religion News Service and author of Strange Rites, New Religions for a Godless World. She looked into these recent connections, and she also discovered the quasi-religious nature of QAnon.
I think that the main one is this kind of vision of a secret order of the world that underpins everyday life, a vision that the world is more than it seems. The social order that we perhaps take for granted is actually underpinned by a secret group of child molesters and Satan worshipers. The other element of that, which is even more vital perhaps, is the way in which that fosters a sense of both community and purpose. The individual poster who goes down this rabbit hole into QAnon isn't just doing this to sort of privately have this information, but through these ritualistic acts of posting, of communicating with others, with other members of these groups, fostering a bond, a band of brothers, and that there's a sort of vague sense, traditionally often online only, but increasingly, as we saw on January 6th, in real life, that there are actions that can be communally taken to, in some way, save the world in this quite die-hard Bruce Willis action movie-esque grand narrative of Campbellian heroism, shall we say.
Do any of these people see the Q figure, who's supposed to be this mysterious government insider, as some sort of messiah? I mean, I get the impression that some do see Q, whoever or whatever it is, in a sort of messianic way.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the people who perhaps have a literal understanding of Q as divine are, of course, few and far between. But I think the sort of messianic quality that because Q is anonymous and because Q's identity is itself ambiguous, there's such room for projection, especially increasingly as the phenomenon has gotten bigger. There's a sort of double consciousness, both of Q as an individual and a poster, and Q as a kind of repository for various fantasies and ideals about the truth teller, the sort of revealer of how the world is kind of inherently broken and corrupt. That certainly has a deeply religious, mystical quality, as too does the fact that when faith in an individual Q wavers, or whether people might believe that a certain person has been finally identified as Q, that doesn't necessarily serve as an off switch to say, all right, this was Q, he's just some guy, he's not who he says he is, therefore that's that. There's still a sense that there must be another layer to this. There must be a deeper secret. And I think that conviction that Q not only can, but perhaps will outlast any conception of the person that is making those drops, makes that even more palpable and true.
Now, Tara, reading your essay, and we'll put a link to that on our website, I was fascinated at the connections that you had seen between QAnon and, of all things, the wellness movement, because at least in the popular mindset, we have an idea of the wellness movement as something almost therapeutic, something good. You saw an interesting crossover. What was it?
Absolutely. So while the Q movement did get its start in the sort of explicitly more right-wing reactionary Make America Again MAGA spaces, increasingly over the past few months, especially during the pandemic, Q has been recruiting not just through the sort of more explicit masculinist language, but rather in wellness Facebook communities, sort of people who might be into something kind of new age, distrustful of institutions, worried about vaccines or pharmaceuticals. That's become a very fertile breeding ground with several notable wellness influencers going down the Q rabbit hole. And I think the thing to keep in mind there is that while often I think that there's a misconception that wellness culture, whether it's spin class or meditation or yoga or crystals, is associated with the progressive left versus the Trump supporters, that there's a clear binary there, I think actually at its core, these ideologies are very similar. They're ideologies of the self. They're ideologies that institutions cannot be trusted. Institutions get in the way of a kind of inner truth, a truth of the gut, and that there's a kind of inward turn that legitimizes both focus on oneself in crystals, but also focus on one's own sort of sneaking suspicion that the world is not quite right, which can then manifest itself through the conspiracy theories of QAnon. And we see that confluence increasingly robustly. I'm thinking, for example, of the QAnon shaman, Jacob Chalmsley, who famously, after his arrest, demanded to change prisons because he was not being served the organic food that his shamanism demanded.
Tara, was the QAnon shaman that you're talking about, is he the one that we see with the horns and the
and
the fur coat? It's fascinating to think that someone dressed in the sort of horns and the painted chest in a very archetypal machismo style could in fact be on the same philosophical wavelength, as you point out, as someone in yoga pants.
Yes and no. I think there's certainly a real different set of gendered symbols that are extremely palpable in these communities. You know, often the sort of the language of QAnon has traditionally been very much the aesthetics of masculinity. But where I think that there's a point of convergence that we see with kind of the broader wellness movement and with far-right groups is an obsession with kind of primality or the aesthetics of primality. So food that is not tainted by big pharma, or an exercise routine that is what our caveman ancestors have done, and a kind of idealized return away from the like urban space that is fetishized in different ways by both communities. My favorite thing that I always like to tell people when this comes up is that Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop, the self-care and wellness brand, and Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist who also sells supplements, many of their products, while they are branded differently as magic moon juice versus masculine man vigor booster, and I'm paraphrasing here, they're actually chemically the same thing, often sometimes even from the same factories. There is really a difference in aesthetics, but the core is quite similar.
I know that the QAnon movement is not necessarily a centralized, highly organized movement. It's so diffuse. But do we know if there's been efforts by the QAnon movement to deliberately infiltrate the wellness movement, to see the wellness movement, in inverted commas, as something that is vulnerable to its message?
Sure. I mean, I can safely say that sort of recruitment has been active and conscious, that people will use certain hashtags, for example, or reach out to certain accounts. That's pretty documented. There was, I want to say, in Elle magazine, quite a good piece about recruitment in the wellness space. But I think that it's also fair to say that because there's sort of a natural existing sympathy between these groups, and even to call them groups, between these subcultures, there's already quite fertile space for crossover. For example, do we think about, you know, someone who is wary of vaccines because they're wary of the pharmaceutical industry to begin with might be someone who can more easily be convinced that 5G is behind the coronavirus and the vaccines will cause Bill Gates to insert microchips into our veins. There is certainly a great element of recruitment there. But to say that it's just that the wellness movement has been co-opted or transformed, even in some small way, would overlook the fact that wellness culture has within it such strong and such strongly individualistic tendencies toward a kind of conspiracy theory vision of the universe combined with what is at its worst, a kind of radical selfishness, a vision of like, I need to live my best life and forget everybody else, that I think translates very easily to the QAnon self-narrativizing heroics of Bruce Willis and this sort of badass hero who's going to break down the system. I think that kind of self-narrativizing is downstream from an existing tendency in American culture, and in particular this aspect of American culture, rather than being merely the provenance of these conspiracy theorists.
I mean, you investigated a lot of this stuff, fascinating, for your recent book, Strange Rites, New Religions for a Godless World, which we discussed last year. Has, by the way, the wellness movement been co-opted by some mainstream religions?
A little bit. I mean, I think that to talk about infiltration and co-option is to perhaps lose sight of the fact that these are fluid boundaries. And certainly, like, churches like Hillsong, a lot of evangelical churches who are treating their services as a kind of cultural product, are conscious that they're competing with, let's say, a SoulCycle class in the wellness space. It is perhaps indeed for the worse the case that the benefits of a religious service are often seen as something that has to be monetized, perhaps sold and packaged as one self-care or wellness option among many. That may mean, and this is an article that came out recently in the Washington Post, Peloton riding for Jesus, or a kind of prayerful workout. I've seen a Christian CrossFit. These are things that I've seen. But I think that individual instances of explicit wellness culture, organized religion overlap are less common than a kind of wider sense that worship has to be packaged as something that's good for the user or provides a feeling of well-being in a certain way, which I think is a wider and more pervasive issue.
Dr. Tara Isabella Burton, she's the author of Strange Rites, New Religions for a Godless World, and there's a link to her column at the Religion and Ethics Report website. Now, you'll also find there a link to an interview that we did back in 2017 with Damon Berry. Now, he's the author of the book Blood and Faith, Christianity in American White Nationalism. We got to this before most people were talking about it. Now, he argues that much of the white nationalist movement, linked these days with QAnon, actually thinks Christianity is too soft and cuddly and multicultural. It's a fascinating insight, and you'll find it at our website. And you're with Andrew West. Joe Biden is only the second Catholic president of the US. The first was John F. Kennedy 60 years ago. So you might think this would please American Catholic leaders, but there's already tension between the new administration and conservative bishops. In Rome, however, Pope Francis is likely to see Joe Biden as a key ally. A new book even argues the fates of the president and the pope are deeply intertwined. Massimo Fagioli of Villanova University is the author of Joe Biden and Catholicism in the United States. He joined me from Philadelphia.
The U.S. bishops, they have reacted in a very particular way, because if one compares the message that they sent after the election of Joe Biden in November 2020 and the message that they sent to Donald Trump 4 years before, it is evident that they are much more worried of having a Catholic like Joe Biden in the White House than Donald Trump. And so what they said was a series of messages after the election and on Inauguration Day that was clearly on the negative side, I mean, warning the president that there is a list of issues on which the bishops are concerned about what this presidency may mean for the Catholic Church, especially on social issues, moral issues. And they have taken steps that are unprecedented, like the formation of a task force of bishops in charge of dealing with the problem of having a pro-choice Catholic president in the White House, which is aimed at issuing a kind of a threat to the president that he may be denied communion at Mass.
Yeah, but we should just clarify here, just to get this right. We've basically got the Catholic bishops of America setting up a special commission to monitor the activities of only the second Catholic president of the United States.
Yes, this is extraordinary because, again, it's something that has never been done. It's something that has really no clear agenda because, again, in the Catholic Church, the only one who has the final say on the reception of the sacraments is the local bishop. And the extraordinary fact is that the bishop who has the final say on this, the ordinary of Washington, D.C., has not been made a member of this special task force.
Massimo, you paint this really quite poignant picture of both Joe Biden and Pope Francis as solitary figures in their own way. How do they share that sense of solitude that you portray?
I believe there's an interesting similarity between both of them. The first thing is that they have been elected to the highest position at a very late age, but most importantly, they have been elected as representatives and as leaders of two communities that are deeply divided. In some sense, it's a tale of two mediocre men that have overcome incredible mistakes and also tragedies. It's interesting to see that in the United States Catholic community, the opposition to Joe Biden coming from Catholics is almost the same of the Catholic opposition against Pope Francis.
What specific causes, Massimo, do you think Pope Francis and Joe Biden will have in common?
Certainly, the first one, I believe, it's the environment. Both of them have called the climate crisis the most serious threat. And so this is a very serious turn from what we have heard for 4 years from Donald Trump. And second, there's the issue of migration and of refugees. More generally, I believe in the Vatican, there has been a huge sigh of relief when they knew that Joe Biden was elected, because the Vatican is really looking forward to more stability and also predictability to the international relations. And so multilateralism in dealing with Iran, Korea, the Middle East also. Of course, in the long term, the Vatican and the West, they have significant differences in how they see the world.
And at home, though, because despite Joe Biden and Pope Francis being of the same sensibility, they're still going to have differences, for example, over abortion. I mean, I know that Pope Francis has said that abortion is not the only thing that Catholics need to think about. It is not the only important issue. But he is still a Catholic Pope who believes in the sanctity of life from the womb to natural death. And there was a time when liberal Catholics, including Joe Biden, probably still believed in that as well. So how much is that social issue still going to be a problem, a difference?
It is certainly the biggest problem domestically for Joe Biden and the US bishops. I believe it is less relevant for his relationship with the Vatican, because it's always been like that between Vatican and heads of state. So here there's a pragmatism. This issue is usually left to the local bishops to deal with, and there's a tradition of not emphasizing too much the areas of difference. And so here, certainly, there is a very significant difference between what is now the political orthodoxy of the Democratic Party and of Joe Biden and Catholic teaching. No question about that. It has become even more extreme in these last few years. But it is something that it's more in the purview of the US bishops than the Vatican. It was the same between Pope Benedict and Barack Obama. John Paul II and Bill Clinton. It's typical of that relationship.
The other big difference that despite their personal affinity, the personal warmth that will appear between Pope Francis and Joe Biden is over geopolitics. I know that Pope Francis and Donald Trump were completely sort of at polar ends. Pope Francis hates nationalism, or at least hates the kind of ethno-nationalism of Donald Trump. But Joe Biden, also who hates that ethno-nationalism, still believes, though, in the idea of American leadership, even if it's got a softer, kinder face. I think Pope Francis, from your book, I get the impression he's pretty skeptical of the idea that America is the center of the world, isn't he?
Absolutely. So here there are short-term convergences, but as you mentioned, there are more substantial differences. Also because, let's not forget, Joe Biden is a Washington insider. He has been there for almost 50 years. And Pope Francis comes from Latin America. And as a Latin American pope, he knows very well what has been the role of U.S. foreign policy in the Latin American continent. And so that is a huge difference between them. But more classically, every pope in this last half a century had serious doubts on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. No question about that. On Israel, and lately on Iraq. The emerging issue is China. I believe that there will be a significant difference between what are the interests of the Vatican about China and what U.S. interests are and the way they can be expressed. And so here there are, on the surface, important areas of collaboration. But on the other side, there are long-term strategic differences that in time will emerge.
On the Religion and Ethics Report with Andrew West, speaking today with Massimo Fagioli of Villanova University in Philadelphia about Massimo's new book, Joe Biden and Catholicism in the United States. You put it, I think, in a very interesting way. You say that there will be tension between Joe Biden's certainly more liberal, open-minded view of America, but what you call Pope Francis as the leader of the global left, if not on the issues that are favoured by social media, then certainly on issues of war and peace and international capitalism. Where is that tension going to be between Biden liberalism and Pope Francis and the global left?
This is an open question. It's not clear if Joe Biden and his team, so where they're going to go with their assessment of these huge changes from the era when the West was the only superpower. And so that world is no longer there. So, but certainly also in areas of foreign policy, the more Catholic candidates would have been Bernie Sanders than Joe Biden. So here Joe Biden is a more America-centered worldview than a candidate like Bernie Sanders, who's more radical, who's more third world, like Pope Francis.
I think you point out that Pope Francis is opposed to what he calls this globalized American way of life. I mean, I guess he's talking there what about the way that American-style capitalism has colonized a lot of the developing world or the global South, including his own Latin America.
That's certainly true, but there's something even more. So here we were used to hear popes being focused on life issues as abortion and the protection of life. So here Pope Francis has waged a significant criticism against a certain way of life. And so, I mean, from life issues to a way of life, which he considers destructive of the environment and of human relations and so on. So this is clearly, even if unstated, it is a clear criticism of the American way of life that we can see in all major documents, especially Laudato Si on the environment, but also this last one that was published in October, the Encyclical Fratelli Tutti, is a statement on human fraternity, but there are incredibly clear passages against death penalty and a justice system and so on that are really targeted at the United States. And so here there is a question how much Joe Biden will align with what Catholics worldwide think about America, which is by and large reflected on what Pope Francis says.
You raise the prospect that Joe Biden, as the second Catholic president of the United States, being not always in lockstep, but let us say more often hand in hand with Pope Francis, could in fact preside over a soft schism in the American Catholic Church. Now, what would that look like in practice?
I believe a soft schism is already here, and I mean not a schism in the way we are used to think about that, like in the Middle Ages with an anti-pope and all of that, but two Catholic cultures that have become significantly different, not only in the way they behave when it's time to vote, in their political behaviors, but also in their theological cultures, in their liturgies, in their worldviews. And so here there are two different kinds of Catholic cultures, of parishes and of communities and of schools that have grown separately, and apparently they are impossible to reconcile. And so this is really unnatural. It is a further step from the creation of a two-party church. It is no longer a coexistence of difference, but there's a tension between differences that are not willing to coexist in one same church. And so this has happened already.
To put this in language that everyone will understand, is this what you refer to as the Trumpist wing of American Catholicism?
It coincides largely with that. So this soft schism was already there before Trump, but certainly Trump has accelerated that dynamic and has also profited by that, because that ultra-conservative Catholicism has espoused Donald Trump as a symbol of the revenge against the 60s and the sexual revolution and all that. So yes, Trumpist Catholicism is not something that will go away with Donald Trump. It will find another name, another leader, but it is not just a political crisis, but also a crisis of religion. And so this is deeper than any one president can do, but this is the situation in which the second Catholic president takes office. And as a Catholic, he will be affected by the situation in one way or another.
Very good to talk to you, Professor Massimo Fagioli. He's a professor at Villanova University. Massimo's latest book is Joe Biden and Catholicism in the United States. Thank you very much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And there are two great articles on this subject, one by Massimo, the other by our colleague Siobhan Marin, and find the links at the program website. You might also be interested in a series of lectures organized by the organization called Heart Edge. These are big discussions about the relationship of faith and commerce and culture and government. There's an online event this Friday, the 12th of February. We'll have our own discussion with the Heart Edge folks later, but you can find them yourself by going online. That is the show for this week. Thanks to Mudita Dias, Tim Jenkins and Jerome Commissari. I'm Andrew West. More Religion and Ethics Report next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.